Hello and welcome to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. So on today's episode, I speak to Ethan, the CEO of Refold, an immersion-based language learning system that offers a guide and community for learners who want to achieve language fluency. So Refold was initially set up by Ethan together with Matt vs. Japan, who's also appeared on this podcast before. And Refold Chinese has its own Discord server, which I recommend all Mandarin learners check out. The community is a great place to exchange tips, chat about language learning strategies, and meet other Chinese enthusiasts. Before we go on to today's episode, I'd like to make a quick announcement from our partner organization, Mandarin Retreat. MandarinRetreat.com are teaming up with space repetition website Hack Chinese to launch a Christmas raffle offering one lucky Chinese learner the chance to win a place on a language learning weekend retreat. The retreat will take place in Scarborough on the southeast coast of England over the Chinese New Year weekend and offers a fully immersive experience. Learners of all levels are welcome to join and will be fully supported throughout the experience. The winner of the raffle will be covered for all transport, food and accommodation costs, including a private bedroom for the duration of the weekend. I myself have taken part in several previous retreats, which I found to be an amazing language learning experience. For full details to enter the raffle and learn more about the retreats, click the link in the description. Now on to today's interview with Ethan from Refold. So Ethan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So first, I wanted to get into your language learning background. When did you first get into language learning and why?
Yeah, so this started in high school, as most people in the States have to take some language. A lot of my friends were taking Spanish and I wanted to be a little different, so I signed up for Japanese instead. And that led me down 4 years of high school Japanese, and then I did 2 years in college. What I learned from that experience was that I was very bad at language learning. It's good at pretty much everything else, and language learning was one of the things that really I always struggled with. And so I came out of that experience speaking no Japanese whatsoever. I obviously can still read the kana, and I know a few kanji, but I was not impressed with my experience, and I was a little disappointed in my own ability to actually learn that. And so that created somewhat of a vendetta in my head against my own language learning ineptitude, that I wanted to fix that and overcome that at some point. And so in 2016, I decided to pick up Spanish. All I knew was that learning Japanese didn't work for me. And so it was either because the language was too hard or because the methods didn't work. So I chose a language that was easier and I went searching for other methods. And in 2016, I spent 6 months going pretty heads down hardcore on Spanish. Did a ton of research in that first week to understand what my method should be and came to the conclusion that I should focus on output first. So that is speaking, putting myself out there, using the language as much as possible, because the conventional wisdom, at least within the content and the strategies that I was looking at, the conventional wisdom was that you have to put yourself in social situations and that signals to your brain that the language is important and therefore your brain will prioritize remembering things. And so I started very heavily with learning grammar and vocab and combining them into sentences. And that method actually works quite well if you want to speak quickly. I was having conversations within a month, and I went to Guatemala after 6 months and studied at a school there for 2 weeks, and everybody was super impressed with how much I could speak after just 6 months. But I came out of that experience being pretty depressed with my own progress, because I couldn't see a pathway from where I was to actual fluency. And so I basically gave up on Spanish at that point and said the only way this is going to work for me is if I actually move down to South America. And so I planned to do that and actually executed on that in 2019. And my plan was to go for 2 years, but the pandemic interrupted that. So I only got 5.5 months. And while I was down there, I was studying in a school, and I reached some point where I was in a conversation with one of my teachers, and I just had a eureka moment that classroom learning was never going to work for me, and that I needed to find another method. And that led me back to the initial searching around for lots of different things, and came across what was called the mass immersion approach at the time with Matt vs. Japan. And that clicked for me. It made a lot of sense. And so I started down that route, and I've been doing that ever since.
You started out there saying that you had an experience, which is quite a common experience, where you were learning a language, in this case, Japanese, in school, and it didn't go very well, which is what tends to happen to most people. They come out from school, they're not able to speak the language that they were supposed to be learning. But in your case, what do you think it was that kept you interested in language learning in general, or still made you want to learn a language? Because in most cases, I think what people conclude then is that, well, they're just no good at languages and they're not interested, so they just give up.
Yeah, I think this is something that's just peculiar about me, is that when I can't do something, it makes me want to do it even more. I don't think everybody has that inclination. And so when I wasn't able to learn Japanese, I wanted to understand why, because as I mentioned, like I was pretty good at every other subject, very good at math, very good at I studied computer science and physics, so I never had any trouble with school. Most subjects were quite easy for me. And so the fact that there was one in particular that was, there were actually two. I was actually really bad at English as well, not the language, but the writing and actually writing persuasion and essays and all that. And that one I actually solved while I was in college. But the language one continued to elude me. And so having this image of myself as, you know, maybe it's just an egotistical thing, but I consider myself a relatively intelligent person. And so the fact that I couldn't do this with any of the tools that have been given to me through school or through the internet really frustrated me and became almost an obsession of trying to fix that problem, which eventually led me to founding Refold with Mattfish Japan.
I remember that I had a kind of similar experience to you in that there was a long period when I was trying out different things, traditional methods, classroom methods, speak from day one methods. And for a period of about a couple of years, I tried all of these things and none of them really quite worked. I mean, they worked to some degree, just like you described, but they clearly weren't making me fluent in the sense that I wanted to be. And then when I came across mass immersion methods for the first time, for me, it was Steve Kaufman's videos and LingQ and graded readers. I started using them more and more. And it didn't take long before I kind of realized, oh my God, actually, this is working. Did you have a similar kind of experience or similar moment where you realized that this actually works?
Yeah, it was almost immediate. One of the traps that I had fallen into in my learning process was that I never felt ready to engage with native content. You know, I had been studying for a year at that point in total, and I had learned tons of vocabulary. I could have conversations. I could have like casual conversations with people, but I couldn't understand people on the street when they were speaking at full speed, and especially not like two natives talking to each other. And I hadn't done a huge amount of input. I hadn't really gotten a lot of exposure to the language in terms of listening to podcasts or watching TV or whatever else. And so when I first learned about input approaches, I went and just listened to a podcast that I had found. And rather than trying to really understand it, I let it wash over me and just tried to pay very close attention to the language. And within just a couple of days, my listening comprehension with people on the street and with people that I was talking to massively increased. It really only took a couple of days for me to demonstrate to myself that this method worked.
I'm wondering when you first then decided to come up with the concept of Refold, and that was a joint venture with Matt versus Japan. What was it that initially you wanted to set out to achieve?
Yeah, so Matt had been working on a guide for language learning, and he had not been making a lot of progress with it. I think a lot of folks really underestimate how difficult it is to write something coherent and that actually makes sense to people and resonates with them. And so in his approach, his attempt to write it, he was really struggling to put his thoughts into words. And so I was part of his community and just waiting around for him to publish this guide. And it was just taking a really long time. So we eventually connected. And at the time, I was actually doing project coaching. So people would hire me and I would basically be their project manager for their personal projects. And so I offered that service to Matt for free because I said, hey, you have this project that you're working on. It's a project that I personally need because I feel like I've plateaued in my language learning and I need to understand how to get from where I am to the next level. And so I will work on this and coach you for free and do the project management for free to help you develop this guide. And so it took us about 4 months of writing, and it started out with me just advising him. And then I eventually actually took over the reins and the entire writing process. I think it was probably 3 months of working on it, 60 to 80 hours a week, really trying to interview him to understand exactly what he believed based on his personal experiences and the many interviews that he had done with other learners. So the process of developing the guide was really this iterative me interviewing him, trying to put his thoughts down on paper, and then showing it to him to see what didn't resonate. And through the course of that iterative process, we developed the Refold roadmap, which was something that was particularly useful for me because I needed to understand how to get to the next level. So on the Refold roadmap, at the time of writing, I was in the 2A, 2B range. And once I had the instructions in front of me, my comprehension and my ability to grow my comprehension just skyrocketed because I finally had the exact tools that I needed in order to make that progress.
You mentioned there that going into this venture, you kind of felt that you needed the guide yourself, and you said that you'd kind of plateaued. In what sense did you feel at that stage that you'd plateaued? Was it that your comprehension abilities weren't advancing to the extent that you would like, or your ability to speak the language? Or what kind of issues were you having with your Spanish at that point?
Yeah, it was comprehension, because I had bought into the input methodology ideas. I was concerned that my comprehension had plateaued, that the recommendations in the original guide were somewhat loose in terms of how you actually tackle language learning. So in particular, the recommendation on when to look things up was do it whenever you feel like it, or whenever things appear or seem familiar to you. And that was something that never resonated with me. I didn't understand it. And so the transition to, we're actually going to separate the activity of immersion into two different things, one where you're focused on looking things up and one where you're not. Just that mental shift made a huge difference in my progress, because I could dedicate certain time to really growing vocabulary, really growing my comprehension using all of the tools available, and then separately spend time solidifying that information by just letting the language wash over me. And that one change in my process really accelerated my comprehension.
Interesting. One thing that I've noticed in the Refold guide and in the on the Refold website is that what it offers is basically a guide and a community to help people achieve high-level language fluency, and that's a quote from the website. I'm just wondering what your definition, everyone has a different one, what your definition of fluency is.
Yeah, this is the never-ending debate. What is fluency? Is it C1? Is it B2? You know, there's all of these arbitrary lines that we've drawn around what is fluency. So for me personally, it's a level of comfort with the language that I can express myself very deeply and understand somebody else very deeply without needing to pause and think, and without needing to search for words or use words that don't actually represent what I'm trying to say. I really want that level of deep comfort with a language similar to what I have in English.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. So one thing I've noticed, because I've been hanging around on the Discord server on Refold and having some really good conversations with other Refolders, and this issue comes up quite a lot about what does fluency really mean? And everyone has a different definition. I think probably from the Refolders I've generally spoken to, probably their definition of fluency, and the one that you've kind of just outlined there, is probably slightly more ambitious than kind of maybe more mainstream versions of what it means to be fluent. Like, I've had people like, for example, Benny Lewis on the podcast before, and he sort of advocates for what he calls socializing equivalence, I think is the term, where basically you're able to function in a social environment with the same ease, basically, as you would in your native language. But I guess there's no right or wrong answer to that question.
No, I don't think there is a right or wrong answer. I think everybody has their own goals, you know, and I respect Benny Lewis because his approach to language hacking, I think, is extremely innovative. And it's a way to take traditional methodologies and convert them into something that's immediately useful, so that, you know, my 6 years of Japanese could have actually just been 6 months of language hacking and gotten me to a much higher level had I been using Benny Lewis's approach. And I think there's a lot of really valuable insights that he's provided that help people reach that level of conversational and social fluency that you described. I think for me, I suppose I am potentially a little too ambitious. But when people imagine fluency, I think myself, when I imagine being fluent, and that goal of being fluent, I imagine comfort at the same level as my native language. And I know that that's extremely difficult to achieve and is likely never to be achieved, but that's what I imagine. And I think that's what a lot of people, when they dream about speaking a second language, they do dream of that level of comfort in the language. Like, when I'm in social situations in English, per se, the level of depth in the conversations is quite shallow. It's a lot of small talk. What do you do for a living? You know, what's an interesting thing about you? Where did you travel last? You know, the basic questions that come up in those social situations with people who you don't know particularly well. And I think that in my experience with Spanish, I did achieve a level where I could have those conversations quite easily, go for, you know, hours speaking Spanish and talking about my experiences in life, etc. But getting into more sophisticated topics, debating politics or talking about economics or giving advice or persuasion, though, that was a level that I felt was so far away from my abilities. I could not see how my small talk level, my ability to interact socially, would ever achieve that greater level of depth in the language.
That makes sense. My experience with Chinese has been that I guess I started out achieving some kind of superficial ability to just hang out with Chinese people and for it to be pretty easy to do that. And then, like you say, but then if I want to talk about astronomy or if I want to talk about like philosophy, I'm really going to struggle. And I guess like where I found the solution to that was rather than in having or coming up with a goal of like becoming fluent in the overall language was to just like pick one subject at a time and then become really fluent in that.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the guide, we talk about this concept of domains, and that's exactly what you're describing. Taking a step back and thinking through what I just explained, one of the issues that I had with my level of conversational ability in Spanish is that there was a very steep cliff after which I could do basically nothing. So I had learned these constructs in Spanish, these sentence constructions. So Mad Libs are this game, at least we have them in the States, where it's a paragraph and half the words or a third of the words are removed. And it just says like noun or adjective, and you fill in the blanks with a partner, and you just ask them for a random noun or a random adjective or a random verb, and then you read it aloud and it makes a funny story. And that's sort of how I treated language learning for the first year that I did it, or rather Spanish learning for the first year, where I had these sentence constructions that are very easy to use. And I would just learn, you know, 100 words, and I could put those words into the sentence so that I could communicate. And that was very useful for being able to communicate. But my output, my speaking was very formulaic because I had, you know, only maybe 100 sentence constructions with a couple thousand or like 1,000 words. And, you know, that allowed me to have these small talk conversations, but it did not prepare me for really listening to natives and really understanding natives at a level of depth that I wanted. And it also meant that if they used a sentence construction I wasn't familiar with, or if I tried to use a sentence construction that I was not comfortable with or hadn't practiced, I would falter. And so I think my language abilities were very rigid when I was in that modality or that way of learning. And so simply transferring to another domain and learning the appropriate words would not necessarily allow me to expand my sentence construction ability or even my like native comprehension ability. And so I think the idea with input-based methods and what makes them different is that it's much more about building a very broad, very deep, solid foundation in how the language works and how the language functions at a subconscious level, as opposed to the very conscious thinking method that I was using in my first attempt at learning Spanish.
One thing I wanted to ask you then is one of the more contentious points in the Refold Guide, which is about the issue of when to output. Currently in the Refold Guide, the suggestion that's made is that you should output at a late stage. So when you've kind of built up very solid comprehension skills, and I think the phrase that's used is when you've reached a level where you can, at least in a particular domain, understand pretty much everything that you're listening to. And at that point, then you can start output practice. But a lot of people aren't really prepared, I think, to like wait that long and prefer to output early. And so I'm wondering, where do you stand on this?
Yeah, this is actually a compromise. Matt and I debated about this for a very long time because in his experience with AJAT, the recommendation was to output when you felt like it. And I think this is an idea that originally came from Krashen, where you don't force people to output at any point. You just wait for them to do it naturally until they've got enough input that the language spills out of them. And so there is no certain point. But from the folks who did AJAT, for the listeners who don't know what AJAT is, all Japanese all the time, the perspective from AJAT was, you know, wait until it feels comfortable to do so, or wait until it's natural to do so. And in Matt's experience, that ended up being, you know, 3-4 years of 8 to 10 hours a day of Japanese, which is an enormous amount of exposure to the language, an enormous number of hours to get to a level where it's appropriate to output. My perspective coming into writing the guide was no one is going to want to do that. Absolutely no one is going to want to wait that long. So if we want to make this more accessible to folks, then we need to bring it down. We need to bring down that threshold of when people should start speaking. And so we settled on the level 5 definition because of an idea that Matt proposed in his video persistent puzzles, where there are deep grammatical concepts in language that you can only understand once you understand 100% of everything else around them. And so the perspective was, if you could get to a level of comprehension within a very narrow domain that would allow you to see and understand intuitively the very deep grammatical structures that come with that, with the language, that it would enable you to create a foundation of correctness in the language that you could then build on top of. You know, as I mentioned, when we wrote the guide, I was not even in stage three. I was not in the output area yet because my comprehension was not even close to that level five at the time. And what I found was, in my own experience going through the guide and learning from, you know, the thing that we had written together, is that the level five definition as it stands today, in my mind, is actually too perfectionist, because it talks about understanding 100% within this small domain. And I think even that is too high of a bar for the average learner. And I'm also not convinced that it's actually the most effective way to do it. I think that the idea of persistent puzzles is valid, but I'm not convinced that simply waiting until it's at an extremely high level, or waiting until your comprehension is super duper high, will actually get you to the point where you do understand those persistent puzzles. There's a theory that in using the grammar that informs, that allows you to test your understanding, and the testing process is what allows you to improve. And I feel like that's something that in the original guide, we did not do a great job of actually integrating, which is the deliberate practice, that's it, where you are identifying things that are just outside of your scope of difficulty and practicing them, getting feedback and improving. And were I to go back and rewrite the guide from scratch, I would center everything around that concept of deliberate practice. So one of the modifications that we've made, because it's been 2 years since we published the guide, and we've been recently working with quite a few clients, we have about 25 clients that we're working with, is that we've put an arbitrary number of vocabulary on what we sort of consider the threshold. So we say 5,000, you know, if you want to say 6,000 or 7,000, choose whatever number you want, but around those amounts. And then the focus is, we still want you to focus on a small domain, but it's less of a hardline perfectionist approach and more of a, we're going to set this arbitrary metric. You're going to become extremely comfortable in this area. And that extreme comfort is really up to you to decide what level you want, and then switch to output.
Mm. I guess one thing I think about this is that, reading through the Refold Guide, I was thinking it might even be the case that, like, if I were following this, I would still never have outputted. And that kind of was mind-blowing to me. And I definitely think there are people in Refold who are higher levels of comprehension than me that have not outputted yet. They're kind of waiting for a later date. And I'm wondering, like, how many people would be, from a language like Mandarin Chinese, would be willing to do that? Like, I think the proportion would be relatively few. Would you sort of agree with that it risks putting some people off?
I think having a hard requirement of it would risk putting people off. But I think we have to reframe the understanding of what those hours actually mean. Because when people think, oh, it takes 1,000 hours to learn a language, they think of classroom time. Whereas from our perspective, we're trying to say, you know, those 1,000 hours don't need to suck. You don't need to be in a classroom, like, learning from a teacher, and, like, you can actually enjoy those 1,000 hours. And so if you can integrate the language into your life, and you can have a high enough level of comprehension where you are engaging in podcasts or YouTube videos or Netflix on a day-to-day basis, then reaching those 1,000 hours actually becomes quite easy, because it's just part of your day-to-day life. You know, for instance, this morning I was listening to a political podcast out of Mexico that was talking about the US elections. And then the second episode was talking about some protests that are going on in Mexico around their election system. And I listen to those because I'm interested in those topics. And so I think from our perspective, it's just most important to get a really solid foundation in comprehension before outputting. What that means and how long to wait is really up to the individual, because everyone has different perspectives. I know that there are fears around solidification of bad habits or poor pronunciation. I generally think that if the amount of input you're getting vastly outweighs the amount of output you're doing, any method will work for you, any order will work for you, as long as you have that balance in mind. You know, maybe it's a 10-to-1 ratio of the amount of time listening to the language versus the amount of time speaking it.
One of the advantages of a method like the Benny Lewis method, and I say this as someone who has followed to learn Chinese has followed something much more like a refold method than a Benny Lewis method. But I guess one of the advantages that I could think of for the Benny Lewis method is that from an early stage, it is an input method. It is an input-based method in the sense that if you're having conversations with native speakers and from an early level, you're getting a lot of input. And this is the point he makes, because they're speaking to you and you have to listen to what they're saying. And so you do gradually build your comprehension skills in the same way. It's just that you're doing it in a social environment. You're doing it while interacting with other people. And I guess at a lower level, you will naturally get more probably input than output, because there's not many things that you know how to say. So those conversations will probably be dominated by the native speakers. And I'm wondering, like, one thing that comes up for me in all of this is that the refold method would seem to me to appeal naturally more to introverted people, whereas the Benny Lewis method perhaps more to extroverted people. Is this like a divide that you kind of see potentially coming up?
My experience with interacting with natives at a lower level of comprehension was that I did not have enough brain power to simultaneously try and parse what they were saying and come up with what I was going to say. And so I would find myself zoning in and out on what they were going to say, or taking a very long time to respond to them. And the challenge, of course, is, you know, you can't look up what they're saying while they're saying it to you. And that the amount of time that you spend with someone is more limiting than the amount of time that you can watch Netflix or listen to podcasts or whatever else on your own. And that brings us to the introvert versus extroverted. I do think that there's a pretty significant difference. I'm relatively introverted by nature. So having a method that allows me to learn without anybody else around me is extremely valuable to me, because it allows me to double or triple the amount of time that I would spend with the language otherwise. In my first attempt at learning Spanish, I did exactly what Benny Lewis described. I put myself in social situations. It almost felt like fighting with the language, trying to like make it do what I wanted it to do. And I did not feel like I was getting enough exposure to understand native speakers. Native speakers continually had to slow themselves down in order to communicate with me. And I always found that quite frustrating, because I wanted to meet them at their level rather than having them come to my level.
That makes sense. One of the things that I remember when I first started learning Mandarin, I used to ask people, how should I learn Mandarin? And people would give answers like, oh, you need to just like spend loads of time with the language. You need to immerse in the language. And then I would try and watch TV programs. And because I'd only just started learning Mandarin, I didn't know anything. So I couldn't understand anything. And even just like the easiest stuff, like if I tried to watch Peppa Pig in Mandarin at that point, I wouldn't have understood anything. And so I think a lot of people have this experience. And so they're kind of initially put off mass immersion approaches, because particularly for a language like Mandarin Chinese, they just literally don't understand anything. And whereas a method like Duolingo caters for people who want to just like learn Mandarin from literally zero, it's a little bit more difficult sometimes for people to see where they should start, right? Like right at the beginning with like a mass immersion approach. So what would you say to those people who are kind of tempted to use beginner's textbooks or Duolingo, which the Refold website advises against?
I actually think that Duolingo does a great job of people who want to test out whether they like a language or not. And they do a great job with creating a daily habit of engaging with a language, probably more than any other learning platform out there or behavior change platform out there. Duolingo has really converted quite a lot of people to engaging with a language on a day-to-day basis. So I don't want to throw too much hate over at Duolingo. I think they do a great job of what they do. I just don't think it particularly works for the level that we're trying to achieve. And so from my perspective, the goal of language learning is imitation. You are trying to imitate what other people do. And if you never expose yourself to what other people are doing, then you don't know how to imitate them. And so our recommendations around engaging with the language on a day-to-day basis is really about just building up a level of comfort with the language, even when you don't understand it. We have this concept of tolerating ambiguity. Some of the folks in the community have relabeled it embracing ambiguity, because it's a necessary part of the language learning process, so you might as well get used to it from day one. The other thing that I would say is that when you're first getting started, the goal is not comprehension. When you're first engaging with a piece of media, the goal is not comprehension, because you don't have the necessary skill set to actually to understand. And so I think people engage with some piece of content, they don't understand it, they get very depressed, And it creates this negative cycle of like, I don't really want to engage with the language. A lot of the recommendations that we propose come from the noticing hypothesis, which is that you need to notice something in the language before you can acquire it and then use it instinctually. And so in that early stage, when you don't understand things, the goal is not to understand. The goal is to notice. You know, if you're spending time with the textbook, yes, it's actually good. You're getting information about the language. But then if you really want to acquire it and acquire an instinct for it, you need to go out and find those things that you're learning about in the real world. So you learn a word, go out and find that word in the real world. And if you're working within those first 1,000 to 3,000 words, you should be seeing many of those words in every single sentence. Even if you don't understand what the sentence says, you should be able to identify the things that you do know within the sentence. And so it's a bit of a mental shift on how you treat the content when you're at the beginning stages of the process.
Yeah. Flashcards and spaced repetition systems. I wanted to talk about that. In the general population, it's probably fair to say that these are not considered the most riveting activities to engage in. They do play a role in Refold, and I've personally like made use of them as well, and I found them very beneficial. Do you see them as something that's necessary, or is it optional? And what would you say to people who hate flashcards?
I hate flashcards. so I fully understand your pain. What I would say is that they are not strictly necessary, but they're highly recommended because they do speed the process up, especially in the beginning phases when you don't understand very much. And I think that one of the things that's really painful about flashcards is when people are memorizing in isolation. And so pairing it with immersion and pairing it with the goal of seeking out what you learn in your flashcards out in the real world makes them a little bit more palatable. At a certain point, the recommendation on flashcards is less strict and less opinionated, because when you can comfortably understand a piece of media and you have, say, 99% word coverage, where 1 in 100 words is unknown, that's a level where, as long as the word is common enough, your brain can mostly pick it out and learn it without explicitly studying it. And that's something that we all do growing up as we learn to read or as we learn words through conversation. And so once you've achieved enough comprehension, you can learn without the use of the flashcards. And this is something that is broadly reported within our community, that folks get to a point and they just turn off Anki because they didn't like it to begin with. They appreciated that it was useful, but then at a certain point, they're like, oh, I'm learning words just from engaging with the language. I don't actually need these cards anymore. And so it may still be more optimal to use the flashcards at that point, in the sense that you can retain quite a lot of information. For people who don't like flashcards, that's a point where you can basically just turn off Anki and continue to learn just directly from the language.
Hmm. The Refold guide in itself is meant to apply universally to all languages and offers advice, but sets out principles that apply regardless of which language you're learning. And I'm wondering whether you think there may be a danger that if someone were to follow the Refold guide to the letter, that it might work out better for some languages and not as well for other languages. I can give you an example. So, for example, we mentioned earlier the input versus output and waiting until level 5 before you output. And there are some examples on the website of people who, for Japanese, basically did that and then woke up one day, essentially, and were able to speak reasonably fluently. And there's examples of that, and they've been documented. And I'm wondering whether it's possible that this might be a lot more difficult for Mandarin Chinese, for example, because in Japanese, my understanding from talking to Matt versus Japan when I interviewed him was that what tends to happen when people input very heavily in Japanese in that way, even people who have at the beginning stages learned about pitch accent, is that they don't really fully acquire the pitch accent and later have to do more work on that. But the equivalent for Mandarin is tones. And whereas pitch accent, it doesn't really affect your ability to communicate fluently in the same way, because you can still be understood. But whereas with Mandarin, if you're speaking with tones all over the place, it's going to affect other people's ability to comprehend you. And so someone at that stage who's gone through the same process for Mandarin might have this like brutal realization that, oh my God, I can't even speak like a 3-year-old. I can't even communicate. So I'm just wondering whether you see this danger of like having one guide that applies to all languages, and whether there may be like nuances depending on which language is being studied.
There are certainly nuances to each language that need to be considered in the guide. You know, the guide is a general purpose thing that needs to be customized to the language. I think in the example that you gave in particular, you know, I have not studied Mandarin, so I can't speak with any sort of authority on it. But at least in the experiences that have been described with pitch accent, one of the reasons that folks can get to a level of fluency without actually knowing pitch accent is because you can understand the language without knowing pitch accent. And so I would actually ask you, do you feel that you can understand Mandarin without being able to recognize tones?
Interesting question. I don't have a concrete answer to that, but I can only go by my own experience, basically, which was that I certainly developed like some degree of, because I learned Mandarin first with bad tones without really paying very much attention to them. I knew they existed, but I hadn't really learned the tone for each character for all my vocabulary, and I wasn't really paying that much attention. And I did like get to a certain degree of listening comprehension, and I felt that it was improving. So I think, and I have met lots of people who are quite high levels of listening comprehension, but when they speak, their tones are all over the place. So they maybe haven't acquired them completely. So I think, yeah, I think it probably is possible.
Yeah, I mean, the brain is very good at filling in things through context. So I would not be surprised if poor tone awareness was still, you could still understand even if you didn't have like perfect tone awareness. I think pitch accent in particular in Japanese is a little different just because you literally can completely understand the language even if you don't know what the pitch is, because the number of lexical changes are quite small and you can usually infer that through context. Whereas I would imagine it'd be much harder in Mandarin to truly understand through listening if you didn't, if you weren't able to detect those tones, based on my limited knowledge of both languages. But what I would say is that one of the aspects that we've modified in the guide in the past 2 years is that there's more deliberate listening and pronunciation practice. And there's a proposed change to stage 2C to integrate more aggressive listening, not just to content, but actually to identifying areas that are difficult for you to hear, and providing some sort of deliberate feedback loop where you can identify those areas and provide practice exercises to improve them. And then from the pronunciation side, integrating chorusing so that you can start to reproduce and then also use your reproduction as a way to identify areas that you're not hearing properly. And so I do think there is very much space, especially in languages like Mandarin and Japanese, to integrate intensive listening and pronunciation practice earlier in the process. I still think though generally that you would want to wait a bit until you have a pretty solid foundation in comprehension, because I just can't imagine studying tones on your day one being very fun.
No, it's not. A lot of the things that we've been discussing today, which we agree on, go against conventional wisdom when it comes to language learning. And I'm wondering whether, as the CEO of Refold, do you view this Refold project as kind of going to war with traditional language learning methods, or do you think the Refold guide can be combined or integrated into more traditional systems like schools and universities?
Yeah, I definitely don't want to characterize it as going to war. That's a very negative way to put it. Fundamentally, we're trying to convince people, right? And if you're coming in with guns blazing, telling everybody that they're wrong all the time, that's unlikely to change any minds. I do think we are trying to change minds, though. And I do think that it's going to be very difficult to change people's minds because the traditional methods are very entrenched in the way that they do things. But to me, it seems somewhat backwards, the way that it's currently taught. You know, I mentioned earlier that I see language learning as a game of imitation. So you need to understand what you're imitating. And if you look at the way that languages are taught currently, they try to teach imitation by teaching rules rather than by showing you what you're supposed to be imitating. And so the analogy that I think of is, imagine you're an American or a Brit and you're trying to imitate the other accent without ever having heard it. And the only information you have are a list of rules that a teacher has given you. I can't imagine that you would be able to produce anything even close to what it actually sounds like if you don't have the opportunity to hear it and expose yourself to it. And so the lack of exposure to real language that I experienced in my language classes, I think is a pretty significant detriment to learners. But I also think that a lot of the traditional methods, you don't need to overhaul them completely. There's still value in them. And the structure that I would propose to traditional language teachers is focusing on comprehension a little bit more aggressively, delaying, you know, writing and speaking for a semester or two semesters so that you're focusing on just really getting that depth with the language, trying to get your students to really enjoy the language and engage with it outside of the classroom is a way I think that we can convince traditional teachers that this would be a good way to teach students. And one of the things that I've noticed recently is that a lot of the tests regarding language learning, but all of the JLPT tests, as well as the CASES test here in the States for learning English, they're all comprehension-based. They don't have a speaking component.
Oh, it's the same with the Chinese HSK test as well.
Yeah. And so it's surprising to me that our traditional education that focuses so much on tests and improving test scores is still focusing on something that the test doesn't focus on. That's something that has never really made sense to me.
Absolutely. A final question I have then. Ultimately, what are your future plans for Refold and what are your ultimate ambitions going forward?
Yeah, so our current strategy at the moment is that we really want to deeply understand every single obstacle that language learners face, which is why we're working directly with clients. Because what we find is that the obstacles that they encounter oftentimes are not with the language itself, but with things surrounding the learning process. So either tools don't work properly, or they don't understand exactly what they're trying to improve to create that deliberate practice loop, or they lose motivation, they don't develop good learning or solid language learning habits. And so there's an enormous amount of things around language learning that need to be solved if we want to improve the success rate of language learners. And I think that they're, you know, Duolingo has done this within sort of a little microcosm of the language learning process, but we still don't know how to do it for the entire process. And so from our perspective and from my perspective, our goal is to really nail down exactly how we keep people on the path towards fluency. And then once we have a very solid understanding of that, creating a very opinionated tool for how to go through the language learning process so that we can really railroad and guide the people so that they just have to show up every day and they don't have to think about how to learn and they don't have to go through the multi-year process of searching around for the right method that works. So the goal for us, for me, for Refold as a company, is to create a process that basically guarantees fluency as long as you follow it, because I have not seen something out there that does something equivalent to that.
Brilliant. Well, I wish you all the best for the future, and I recommend all my listeners go out and check out Refold. I'll put a link in the description, and also check out the Discord server, which I've been spending time on, which is a really awesome community for people exchanging tips for learning Mandarin and other languages as well. So once again, thank you, Ethan, for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Misha.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.